Good evening. Thank you so much for coming out tonight. I am glad to see you. Appreciate you coming, and it's good to be back with you. We are going to cover the life of John Knox, and I must tell you that it is his life that I enjoy telling most from the Reformation. That is enough so that I bounced John Calvin to put John Knox in the series. And John Calvin is probably my favorite reformer, but John Knox's life, I think, illustrates Calvin's great theme better even than Calvin's life does. And that is the theme of the sovereignty of God. I'd like to begin with a text of Scripture. I've printed the text for you up here on the screen, so you don't necessarily need to turn to it. It's Paul preaching at the Areopagus in Athens before the Athenians. And here's what he said at sort of the high point of that sermon. God that made the world and all things therein, seeing that he is Lord of heaven and earth, dwelleth not in temples made with hands, neither is worshipped with men's hands as though he needed anything, seeing he giveth to all life and breath and all things, and hath made of one blood all nations of men for to dwell on the face of the earth, and hath appointed and hath determined the times before appointed and the bounds of their habitation that they should seek the Lord, if haply they might feel after him and find him, though he be not far from every one of us. What is Paul's point at this key point in the sermon? Well, his point is that there is a sovereign God over all nations, over each of us, and over all things. That is, he was confronting the polytheism of the Athenians, who believed there were lots of gods, each of which you could worship according to your preference. And Paul says there's one God, and if there's one God and he is a transcendent sovereign God, then that rules out all the other gods and it makes tremendous demands on us because in him we live and have our being and we will answer to him and everything about life is under his authority. That is Paul's theology. What is the appropriate response to that? Well, let me just cite one appropriate response. The wicked flee when no man pursueth. And how does that psalm, that proverb end, Proverbs 28:1? But the righteous is bold as a lion, Proverbs 28:1. My theme tonight relative to John Knox is that his confidence in the sovereignty of God, and John Knox was a disciple of John Calvin and studied under him for several years, and his confidence in the sovereignty of God worked in him a boldness that is a model and example for all of us. I was praying this afternoon about tonight and asking the Lord to once again work in my heart to enable me to be what I am not naturally, and that is bold. That is, if I have a choice in any tough situation, I will turn tail and run. I will find a way out of that situation. That's my nature. And John Knox is every time I consider this man's life, I am rebuked in that he had lots of opportunities, as we'll see, to avoid the battle. But his confidence in a sovereign God caused him to engage the battle. So let me begin in Scotland in the early 16th century. He is now a later generation from Luther and Zwingli, who were born 1484, 1480, 1483, 1484. Tyndale, born mid-1490s. John Calvin is born in 1509. Knox is born in 1515. So he is born in or near Haddington, East Lothian, Scotland. And that's, you can't see it too well, but it's way over on the left-hand side in next to virtually nothing. His parents were middle-class farmers. He was born around 1514, 1515. We know almost nothing about his upbringing, but he's able to attend St. Andrew's University. It's expected that he probably received some type of support from nobility to get him into that school. So he's studying at St. Andrew's, and while he's there, an event occurs which he may have witnessed. He tells the story in his A History of the Reformation in Scotland. Knox himself wrote A History of the Reformation, and the way he recounts this story sounds like an eyewitness account. In 1528, when he was a teenager, 13 or 14 years old, he witnessed the burning of Patrick Hamilton. This man had gotten saved by reading Luther's writings. He had gone to Germany. He had studied under Luther for a little while. He was embraced there. And then as a man in his 20s, he was burdened for Scotland. And he says, I've got to go back and share with my countrymen the Reformation, the evangelical truth of justification by faith. And he came back to Scotland and had been in Scotland for just a short time, preaching the truth, trying to win people to Christ. When Hamilton was arrested, he was taken to St. Andrews and he was burned at the stake. Knox may have witnessed that. Knox himself was ordained as a priest in 1536 when he was in his early 20s. He got a job working for the Pope. He was a papal notary, so he was sort of a scribe for the church where he would copy down edicts and legislation and whatnot. It was a pretty light job starting in about 1540. And then something else happened to get his attention. A friar by the name of Alexander Seton. Friars are like monks, except they don't live in monasteries. They travel around begging alms and preaching and living off the people. A friar read Luther's works and got saved. Went to Germany, met Luther, stayed there for a short time, and then decided that he was burdened for Scotland. I've got to go back and tell my people. Seton came back to Scotland and was traveling around as a friar, and now he's preaching evangelical truth. He's telling people that the sacraments won't save you, Christ alone saves. And Seton got arrested. And he was dragged before the archbishop, Cardinal Beaton. And the archbishop confronted him and said, I have heard that you are saying that it behooves a bishop to be a preacher, or else he's just a dumb dog and feeds not the flock, but feeds his own belly. Did you say things like that? And Seton said, my lord, the reporters of such things are manifest liars. And the bishop said, I rejoice to hear that. Your answer pleases me well. I never could think that you would be foolish enough to affirm such things. Where are the slaves that falsely accused him? And they brought in the witnesses. And the witnesses said, we heard him say it. We heard him say that if a bishop's not a preacher, he's a dumb dog and feeds not the flock but his own belly. And as the witnesses were multiplying, they said, what do you say to this, Friar Seton? I mean, all these people can't be lying about you. And here's his answer. My lord, you may consider what ears these donkeys have, who cannot tell the difference between Paul, Isaiah, Zechariah, Malachi, and Friar Alexander Seton. In very deed, my lord, I said that Paul says it behooves a bishop to be a teacher, and that Isaiah says, they that feed not the flock are dumb dogs. And that Zechariah said, they are idle pastors. Of mine own head, I affirm nothing. I declare what the Spirit of God had before pronounced. If you're not offended at the Holy Spirit, my Lord, you dare not be offended at me. So yet again, my Lord, they are manifest liars that reported that I said unto you, said that you and others that preach not are no bishops but belly gods. You say, well, the guy was kind of cheeky. Well, he kind of was, but he was also pretty bold. And notice the point he made. It's a point that I tried to make yesterday, that the archbishop wanted it to be Friar Seton versus himself. And Friar Seton said, it's not about Alexander Seton. It's about Paul and Isaiah and Zechariah and Malachi. And your battle, archbishop, is with them. The authority lies in the scriptures. Now, fortunately for Seton, he was banished from the country and went to the continent and died there and was not burned at the stake. But his point was made. It's not the Protestants' authority against the church's authority. It's the church's authority against God's authority, the scriptures. So I'm going to give you tonight, as we go through Knox's life, a series of principles of boldness. Let me suggest that the first principle of boldness is I don't speak on my own authority but God's. It would scare me to death to confront people if I had to confront them on the basis of my intelligence and my knowledge and what I know, my authority. But I can confront people when I'm saying, thus saith the Lord. And I open the Bible and let them see what God says to their situation. And if you deal with sinners much, they're going to ask, yeah, but my church says, your church says that, my church says this. And I always want to get the conversation away from my church, your church. Let's not worry about what the churches are saying. What does God say? What does the Word of God teach? Well, in the 1540s, another man came into his life. The first influence, perhaps, was Patrick Hamilton. The second influence was Alexander Seton. The third influence was a man by the name of George Wishart. Interestingly, we had a couple of Wishart's on campus a couple of years ago whose dad said they were descended from George Wishart. I would like to think that's true. He was another Scot who was exposed to Lutheran teachings, got saved, and you know what's going to happen. He went to Germany, and he studied under Luther for a little bit, and he came back to Scotland because he had a burden for the Scottish people. By this time, the scriptures are beginning to spread through Scotland, especially the lowlands and a little bit up into the mountains. It's going to take a long time to evangelize the mountains of Scotland. But through the major cities, Edinburgh and Glasgow and Aberdeen and St. Andrews, the scriptures are making their way, and people are beginning to be influenced. And Wishart showed up, and he was a powerful preacher. And he began preaching justification by faith. And sometime between 1540 and 1545, there's Mr. Wishart, John Knox got saved. I sure wish I could tell you more about it. Knox, in his own story of the Reformation, presents himself as, I was converted by the glorious gospel and became a follower of George Wishart. In fact, what he became was his bodyguard. January 1545, he got himself this big old sword. He's called it a double-handled broadsword. And he followed Wishart around, and as Wishart was preaching, Knox would stand back behind him with his broadsword, sort of like daring anybody to bother Wishart. And he had no thought that he was going to be a preacher. He was simply the bodyguard. Knox was a big man by the standards of the time. That is, he stood 6'1", 6'2", which was towering above a lot of people in the 16th century. And as Wishart traveled around Scotland preaching with Knox in tow, revival broke out in several cities. And then the archbishop contacted Wishart and said, I would like you to come to St. Andrews for a little powwow. We need to talk about your doctrine, and we'll discuss possible changes in the Church of Scotland. We can negotiate a little bit. What do you say? And Wishart agreed to go there. And Knox said, they're going to kill you when you get there. Don't do it. And Wishart said, yes, they're going to kill me when I get there, and I've got to do it. And Knox said, well, then I'm going to go with you, and I'm going to have my broadsword, and I'm... No, you're not going to go with me. Wishart said, one sacrifice is enough at this time. You stay behind, Knox. You're going to be needed. You're going to take my place in this Reformation. Well, that was the last thing Knox wanted to do. Knox didn't view himself as a George Wishart, a man that could stand before crowds and preach with power. He was just a papal notary. And Wishart was, when he arrived in Edinburgh, he was arrested instantly. No powwow, no discussion, no debate. And just a few hours after being arrested, early in the morning, he was burned at the stake. Because Wishart had gained a fair amount of notoriety during his travel around Scotland, and the bishop was afraid that people would object to burning this holy man of God to death. That's how things are beginning to change in Scotland. Well, they burned him to death, and two months later, some of the nobility in Scotland were very upset at Wishart's death. And there's more going on than meets the eye, and I can't discuss all the geopolitical situation, but Scotland is north of England and across the channel from France, and the French at this time had almost complete control of Scottish politics. That is, they controlled the succession, there were French armies in Scotland, the French navy patrolled the coast, and the English were trapped between the French and the Scottish. And the Scots and the French were strong allies. But there were a lot of Scottish nobility who didn't like it. They thought the English, who spoke a language that was a lot closer to their own, were very much more natural allies. And they didn't like having the French as their allies. And when Wishart came and was preaching salvation by faith, Reformation was already taking place in England. And a lot of these nobility, for political reasons, thought Reformation would be a good idea. That is, I don't know if any of these people were saved, but they thought Reformation would be a good idea. They wanted the French out of Scotland. And 2 months after Wishart's death, they snuck into Beaton's castle and assassinated him, hung his body out the window. They then seized control of the castle, a group of rebels, and they really thought that the whole country might rally to their cause. Well, that didn't happen. But there they were in the castle, and they took their families and just settled in the castle and tried to hold out, hoping that they would be able to start a revolution. John Knox was invited to join them in the castle as the tutor for their children. There's no evidence that Knox was involved in the assassination. He doesn't speak of it as though, "I'm really sorry Cardinal Beaton got killed." But on the other hand, he doesn't endorse assassinations. But he was in support of the Reformation, and he joined the rebels there in the castle, and he began teaching their kids. He supported their aspirations for independence. And after they'd been there for a short time, these rebels said, "We want you to be our preacher." There are the remains of St. Andrew's Castle. "We want you to be our preacher. We don't really have somebody to hold services for us." And when Knox was asked to do that, he said, I could never do that. I could never be a preacher. In fact, when they confronted him in public to do it, he fled the room in tears. How many of you have seen the movie Sheffy? Oh, just a couple of you. It's a Bob Jones film that was made a number of years ago about a Methodist circuit riding preacher. Same thing happened to Sheffy. The first time he got up to preach, he freaked out in the middle of a sermon, tried to run out of the building, and one of the deacons chased him and tackled him and dragged him back into the building. Well, that's sort of a Knox thing. Knox cries and says, "There's no way I could ever preach." And he couldn't escape the call of God in his life, and he finally accepted it. And from the very beginning of his preaching ministry, the people said, "This man has the touch of God in his life. He is ordained of God to preach." Later, they're going to say, "Others lop off the branches of the papacy, but he strikes at the root to destroy the whole." That is, he preaches with power. Knox, all his life, is going to be a powerful communicator. Well, there they are in the castle. Nobody's rallying to their cause. The inevitable happens. A French fleet shows up in 1547. And the rebels couldn't hold out against the French fleet, and they surrendered. So what's going to happen to them? Well, the gentlemen, the nobility, are put in prison. But Knox wasn't one of the nobility. He was a commoner. He was farmer stock. And the commoners were made galley slaves. How many of you have seen Ben-Hur? Surely more of us. Okay. Yeah, so you know what the galley slave life is going to be like. When you were put on a galley to row, you were there till you died. That is, you didn't row for 6 months and get a reprieve or a year. They sent you to the galleys like the Romans would send people to the mines to get as much out of you until you collapse and die, throw you overboard, and find somebody else. And so he was put on a galley because Knox was a commoner, and he rowed on that galley across the Mediterranean Sea mostly for the next 19 months. For the next 19 months, never expecting to get off. From June 1547 to March 1549. Knox tells us one story that occurred during his months on the galley, and I repeat it just so you'll sort of get a notion of his personality. They brought around a little statue of the Virgin Mary and insisted on all the prisoners kissing the Virgin as it went by. And they brought it to Knox and said, "Kiss the Virgin." And he took it and held it up to his face and then heaved it over the side of the boat into the ocean and said, "Let Our Lady now save herself. She's light enough. Let her learn to swim." He does not tell us what they did to him as a result. We know he survived, but they could not have been happy. His only comment was, "After that, no Scotsman was urged with that idolatry." Of course, they may not have had another statue on board. I don't know. But in 1549, after he had been there for 2 years, he was paroled very unexpectedly. Henry VIII had died in 1547. His son, Edward VI, was 9.5 years old. But Edward was a genuine believer. His mother had been a believer. And the government was led by people who wanted reformation. And the Reformation took off in England. And we found out somehow, and again, there's details here we don't know, that Knox was a prisoner on board this French ship. They arranged a prisoner exchange. And Knox was released and brought to England. Second principle, God is in control of every situation. That is, this is a path that Knox would not have designed for himself. That is the path of his mentor being burned at the stake, of him being thrust into a preaching position he did not desire, of him being sent to a galley to row for a year and a half, and now being in England among Englishmen who were the enemies of Scotland, who are the enemies of Scotland, and now being given a pastorate there. But if you need boldness, probably the most helpful consideration at the moment that you need it is, God put me in this situation at this time for this purpose. Well, he came to England. English reform was being led by the Archbishop of Canterbury named Thomas Cranmer. Cranmer was a good man in many ways, but he believed in formal liturgy. In fact, he was one of the authors of the Book of Common Prayer. And the Book of Common Prayer is a collection of prayers that they would read in the services of the Anglican Church. I don't know if you've ever handled the Book of Common Prayer. It's got a lot of beautiful prayers in it. And then it's got some prayers that are, you know, that talks about Mary and various things in ways that we would, as Baptists, not be comfortable with. But we're never comfortable with the stipulation that our worship must have read prayers. That is, Knox did not like church in which he had to wear robes and light candles and repeat ceremonies and read prayers. That was not what church was about for him. He wanted something far more spontaneous. And his objections caused them to sort of banish him to a little town way up near the Scottish border, basically as far from London as Cranmer could get him. But they did want to use him in the Reformation, so they gave him a pastorate of a little English town, and he began to serve up there as a pastor in northern England. And that was of the Lord also. He was a passionate, dedicated pastor, and he met a young lady there, a noble woman who was converted under his ministry. Her name was Marjorie Bowes. And in 1553, after he'd been there for about 4 years, he and Marjorie got engaged to be married. Things were looking very good at this point. Edward was a teenager. The Reformation was advancing rapidly. All the leaders of the Reformation were godly men. And Knox was pastoring a church. He was close to Scotland, and he was still praying that someday he'd be able to return to his homeland and preach the gospel. And then all of a sudden, Edward VI died. He was 16 years old, and he died. You know who succeeded him as the ruler of England? Yeah, Mary Tudor, known to history as Bloody Mary. Mary's mother was the one that Henry had divorced back in the 1520s to start the Reformation in the early 1530s. And she was a staunch Roman Catholic. And Mary desired to restore the Roman Catholic Church to England. Now, that wasn't going to happen. The Reformation had gone too far too fast. But she was going to try. So what she began to do was gather up the bishops of the church and execute them. She had a whole series of burnings. And now every pastor in the church has to decide what he's going to do about this. Is he going to stand, or is he going to flee? And some of them said, "We dare not abandon our post. We can't give the church over to Mary's creatures. We're going to stand, and if she kills us, she kills us." And there were a series of great martyrs. I'll mention five of them, or four of them. John Rogers, who was one of Tyndale's assistants doing translation work. Hugh Latimer, one of the greatest preachers England ever produced. Nicholas Ridley, one of her greatest scholars. And finally, Thomas Cranmer himself was burned at the stake, and about 296 others. She burned about 300 bishops in 5 years. But others said, this is not the time for us to, this is not our battle. And hundreds fled England, including John Fox. What's he famous for? Fox's Book of Martyrs, the Acts and Monuments of the Church by John Fox. If Fox had stayed and died, we would have lost a classic treasure of martyrology. But he believed it was his calling to capture for the world what was happening in the country. And the very best parts of his book are the parts that happened while he was alive, giving eyewitness accounts. And the other was John Knox. John Knox's burden is for Scotland. He's not going to die for England. All right, his burden is for Scotland. And so he took off for the continent along with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of others. You say, well, the martyrs had faith, and those who fled did not have faith. Let's not be hasty about that. God may have a different will for different people. That is, in Acts chapter 12, Herod arrests James. And I'm sure the church was praying for James. And what happened to him? He was killed. He was beheaded. And then Herod arrested Peter, and the church was praying for Peter. And what happened? He was delivered. You never know what God's sovereign pleasure is in an individual life. God had another work for Knox to do. So he arrived on the continent. By the way, he had to leave Marjorie behind. They were engaged to be married, but as they were awaiting their nuptials, he suddenly had to get out of town. And he fled to Germany. And he became a pastor to English refugees in Frankfurt, Germany. Well, right away, he started battling with them over reading prayers because they were Anglican and they wanted to hear prayers in the Book of Common Prayer and they wanted Knox to wear robes and they wanted, and he said, I never wanted to do all this stuff and I'm not going to do it now. And so after pastoring them for a few months, he said, enough's enough, I'm leaving, and he went to Geneva, Switzerland. He went to Geneva because that's where John Calvin was, and he had heard of Calvin. He'd never met him, but he'd heard about him and he wanted to meet him. Nearly half his church in Frankfurt picked up and moved with him to Geneva. And there were a bunch of refugees already in Geneva that had come from England. And he now was pastoring a church of 500 or 600 people. It was a very large church by any standards, but especially in the 16th century. It was a thriving English-speaking congregation. Furthermore, he began meeting with John Calvin every week to discuss theology. So, well, how did they do that? Well, they both spoke Latin. Right, they both were university trained, and they could interact in Latin, and Calvin began teaching Knox theology. Now, Calvin was only about 5 years older than Knox, but they interacted for several years, and Knox picked his brain, and for good or bad, and this is no defense, I mean, there are many things about Calvin's theology that I, as a Baptist, would not be comfortable with, but Knox became a thoroughgoing Calvinist. I mean, he just absorbed everything Calvin taught him, and if Knox disagreed with Calvin in some area, I've never discovered it. But he still had a heart for Scotland. And in 1555, if you're trying to keep up with the years, this is now 2 years after he fled Mary's persecution, he decided he would head back to Scotland for a visit. Let's just see what's going on there. So he sailed up to the country. He had to sail around England because Bloody Mary was there. But he was able to get to the country, and he discovered that the nobility were becoming more and more Protestant, and that there was a grassroots Reformation movement taking place, and there was no Wishart, there was no Hamilton, there was no Seton, there was just the Word of God that was quietly doing a work across the country. And as Knox began to visit city after city, people started rallying to him, and he was amazed by what God was doing. Marjorie heard that he was there. He contacted her, wrote to her. She crossed the border, joined him in Scotland, and they were married. But it wasn't time yet for him to settle there, and he returned. Let me mention their family. Over the next 4 years, she bore him 2 sons. I'll say more about them shortly. They returned to Geneva at the end of the trip. When he left, the archbishop in Edinburgh said, "He got away. I didn't know Knox was in the country." And they burned him in effigy in Edinburgh, and that's what they would have done to him if they had caught him. That very year, they were burning Ridley and Latimer and Cranmer, and if they had caught Knox, that would have been the end of his career. So how is he going to influence the Reformation there? Well, he decides to do something he's not done before. He takes up his pen and begins writing Reformation pamphlets, and he writes a number of them. Scotland at this time was under the rule of Mary of Lorraine. She was a dowager princess in charge of the country while the young ruler grows up, Mary Stuart. She was French. She barely spoke any English, had no connection whatever with the Scottish people. She was a strong Roman Catholic related to the French royalty. So Knox begins writing pamphlets that describe justification by faith. that describe the authority of Scripture, that describe the priesthood of the believer. Principle three, we must have a burden for souls. Knox was pretty happy in Geneva. He could have settled down there and pastored and lived in almost complete safety for the rest of his life. Nobody would have ever come to Geneva and arrested Knox. But he had a burden for Scotland. And he couldn't escape that burden. His heart was there. And he wanted to be there in person. If he couldn't be there in person, he was going to write pamphlets. And unfortunately, he wrote a pamphlet that he regretted. Oops. His most famous pamphlet, and his most ill-advised, was entitled "The First Blast of the Trumpet Against the Monstrous Regiment of Women." At this time, three of the leading rulers in Europe were Mary Tudor, who was Bloody Mary killing people in England, Mary Guise, who was Mary of Lorraine, the enemy of the faith in Scotland, and Mary Stuart, the young Scottish princess who's going to turn out to be as bad as the other two Marys. All of these Marys ended up being terrible rulers and immoral women and persecutors of the faith. So if your name is Mary, I'm sorry. It's not going well for Marys at this point. Now, unfortunately, there was another woman that would have made a great friend to John Knox. Her name was Elizabeth. And Elizabeth, when she read that tract against the monstrous regiment of women, she never had any use for Knox the rest of his life. That is, she was deeply offended, and also she felt threatened because she's going to be the queen now. And Knox basically says, here's what happens when women rule. Let's see, we got Jezebel, Athaliah, Mary Guise, Mary Tudor, and Mary Stuart wasn't around yet, but that's what happens when women rule. Don't let it happen to you. And then Elizabeth becomes queen. Elizabeth succeeded her sister Mary, who died quite young in 1558. She reestablished Protestantism in England. When she did, Knox's congregation in Geneva said, you know what, I think we can go home now. That is, it's safe to return to England. And most of them picked up and went home. And now Knox is in Geneva with no church. He said, I think it's time. But now, what do you expect to happen to Knox when he gets to Scotland? Hamilton returned to Scotland. They burned him at the stake. Seton returned to Scotland and was arrested and banished. Wishart returned to Scotland and they burned him at the stake. Prospects don't look good. And it's easy, looking back, to say, yeah, but a lot's changed. Well, the last time he was there, they were burning him in effigy. He goes back to Scotland with his wife and with his young sons, not at all knowing what's going to happen to him. And so I entitled the slide, No Fear of Man. He arrived in Scotland on May 2nd, 1559. You don't have to remember the day, but it's the middle of the year, 1559. Keep that in mind. Reformation is usually a slow, difficult process. It took him a while to sail to Scotland because, once again, Elizabeth wouldn't give him passage to England. And she's never going to like Knox. The archbishop finds out he's here. And what I'm going to give you now is what Knox records in the history of the Reformation of Scotland that the archbishop issued as a challenge. I think Knox may have reworded this a little bit, but this is exactly what he says in his book. In case John Knox presents himself to the preaching place in his town and principal church, I want him to be saluted with a dozen muskets, and I want most of them aimed at his nose. Right, there's the welcome that the archbishop wants for John Knox. And here's John Knox. Once again, I think John Knox, if you read his history of the Reformation in Scotland, he has a wonderful sense of humor. He's always portrayed as the dour Scot. And he's actually he was a very funny man, at least in his writing. But here's Knox's reply to this challenge. And I think it shows us his heart. As for the fear of danger that may come to me, let no man be solicitous. My life is in the custody of him whose glory I seek. Therefore, I cannot so fear their boast or tyranny that I will cease from doing my duty when of his mercy He offereth me the occasion. So I'm going to do the right thing. And if they kill me, they kill me. Boldness number four, we must move forward with a sense of divine mission. One of the things that will enable us to do the hard thing is when we know the hard thing we're doing, God told us to do. Knox had a sense of divine mission. What's going to happen next is simply amazing. Mary of Lorraine put a price on his head, ordered his arrest. But the Scottish nobility, by this time, rallied to Knox. Almost all of them defied Mary of Lorraine to her face. They began assembling an army to face the French. Knox was not a political leader. Knox was not going around trying to rally an army. He was preaching the gospel. But God had prepared the hearts of a great many people. So Mary had a small French army, but most of her advisors started defecting. And she discovered that she had very little support. Furthermore, Queen Elizabeth heard what was happening. And even though she didn't like Knox, she wanted the French out of Scotland. And she sent an English army up to help out. And the French scattered. They got on board a ship and took off. And then, to cap it all off, Mary of Lorraine suddenly died. 13 months. 13 months. Knox goes back expecting to be a sacrifice. 13 months later, the French are gone, Mary's gone, and the country's Protestant. Scotland was free of France and Rome. The Scottish nobility formed themselves into a parliament and called themselves the Lords of the Congregation. Now, we Baptists, we're not crazy about parliament being the Lords of the Congregation, but this is a huge change. Papal authority was officially abolished. The Mass was outlawed. Knox was asked to write a confession of faith for the Scottish Church. So he did. He wrote the confession of faith that is going to be the confession for the Scottish Church for the next 4 centuries. Like Pastor said, the Scottish Church today is embarrassed by Knox. And they disavow him and distance themselves from him. But as recently as the 1850s and 60s, you still had a very strong evangelical church in Scotland. That's a 20th century development. It's very sad. Knox became the leading preacher in Edinburgh. Calvin wrote to him when he heard about it and said, as we wonder at success so incredible in so short a time, so also we give great thanks to God. We know who did this. God did this. But Knox was not without trials. At the height of his triumph, in December of that year, his wife Marjorie passed away, still a very young woman. Knox was left with 2 boys, ages 3.5 and 2, to care for while he's trying to manage a country, while he is the primary advisor to the parliament, while he is designing the book of discipline for the Church of Scotland. And about 4 years later, he remarried a noblewoman, one of the daughters of one of the parliament members by the name of Margaret Stuart. This marriage was somewhat controversial. He was 50 years old at this time. She was 17. And even in the 16th century, eyebrows shot up and stayed up for a long time at this point. All I can tell you is that she is going to bear him 3 daughters, Martha, Margaret, and Elizabeth. All 3 of those daughters are going to marry Scottish preachers, one of whom, John Welch, is going to be one of the great Scottish preachers. I'd like to tell you John Welch's story. It's tremendous. She is going to faithfully stay with him until his death, and then she's going to become something of a matriarch. She's going to outlive him, of course, by about 40 years, and she's going to become a matriarch of the Scottish Church and one of the, you know, advisors to pastors. So, unusual, but I refuse to join the criticism brigade. That's what they did. But you know what? Tough times are coming. Because Mary Stuart, the daughter of Mary Lorraine, has been in France all this time. In fact, she's married to the King of France, and he suddenly dies. And she has no reason to be in France anymore, and she returns home to her Scotland, expecting to be the queen. She's 18 years old. She's also worldly, frivolous, and immature, and she's staunchly Roman Catholic. She arrives in a country where it's against the law to have Mass. She has a private priest that she carries around with her to confess her sins to, and it's against the law to have Mass. So Knox denounced her Romanism, and she summoned him for interviews, four very memorable interviews. I would suggest that you read his History of the Reformation in Scotland if you would like the text of these interviews. They're remarkable. For time's sake, I took a lot of this interview material out of the lesson. In short, Knox said, "Your Highness, you may be the queen, but you are not God. And God is ruling in Scotland now. And you answer to him just like the rest of us do. And in fact, in his eyes, you're just a member of the Kirk." Right, the KRK is what the Scots always called their church. And she didn't like that. She said, "Do you mean to tell me that you and the pastors are going to tell me what to do?" He said, "Of course we're not going to tell you what to do. We're simply going to tell you what God's word says, and it's going to tell you what to do." And she was outraged. And they had conflict for several years, but she was a very, very wicked and immature woman. She became embroiled in terrible scandals, committed adultery against her husband, one of the noblemen, had her husband murdered and then married the adulterous murderer, and the Scottish nobles had had enough. They deposed her, they imprisoned her, and they kicked her out of Scotland. She went to her cousin, Elizabeth, down in England, and asked her for refuge. And Elizabeth said, "Okay, you can live here in England." And while she's living in England, Elizabeth had no children, which meant if Elizabeth died, the next ruler of England would be the closest kin. And guess who the closest kin was? It was Mary. And Mary was continually involved in intrigues against Elizabeth. She writes letters and tries to form, and finally Elizabeth gets tired of it and throws her in the Tower of London. And she languishes in the Tower of London for over 10 years, and finally, on February 8th, she is beheaded at age 44. Hollywood has made this lady a tragic character. That is, whenever her life is dramatized, she's always the victim of the evil Knox and the evil Elizabeth. That is not the correct story. She's gone now, and Knox preaches at the coronation of her infant son, whose name was James. James is going to grow up without his mom or his dad. He's going to grow up under the care of the Scottish pastors, and his name was James VI of Scotland. In 1603, he's going to be invited to become the successor of Queen Elizabeth in England. And he's going to become King James I of England, who authorizes the King James Version of the Bible. And then I'd like to tell you he was a wonderful person, but he wasn't. He was pretty much like his mother, actually. We come to the end of Knox's life. Pastor said you could ask questions, so I'm just going to go ahead and finish. His final days, in 1570, he suffered a stroke. He was just 56 years of age. It greatly weakened him. He struggled for the remainder of his life, his last couple of years, rarely went out except to preach. But we have a contemporary testimony about one of his sermons after that stroke. Here's what the contemporary said. "Though he was then very weak in body, he would not refrain from preaching. And when in the pulpit, he behooved to rest some time before he could proceed to preach." Now, understand that his pulpit in St. Andrews has a spiral staircase that leads up to an elevated platform with a sounding board. So to get to where he had to preach, he had to climb a bunch of steps. And that's probably what that's referring to. He would work his way up there, and then he'd rest for a while, and you can imagine everybody waiting for Pastor Knox to start preaching. But ere he ended his sermon, he became so vigorous and active that he was like to have broken the pulpit to pieces. And that's the testimony about Knox's preaching. He was a dynamic preacher. Principle of boldness, number 5. Ultimately, it's about God, it's not about me. This story from Knox's deathbed has been a great challenge to me. And I think it shows his character maybe better than anything else I've said tonight. His health began to fail rapidly in October and November of 1572. He was not an old man. That is, he was in his late 50s. And one night, towards the end, he was struggling with his sleep, turning and tossing, talking out loud. As was often the case with these godly men, when they thought he was going to die, his named successor, Andrew Melville, and a number of other men gathered in his bedroom, and somebody was always there to capture his last words. I don't know if you've seen these little booklets from the Reformation period. They would put out last words of great saints, and they were considered testimonies of the triumph people would have on their deathbeds. It was considered a refutation of atheism. That is, godly people die with joy. But Knox was having a rough time of it. And he was struggling, and he looked like he was in pain and suffering, and he was crying out. And they asked him in the morning, why are you having such a rough time? You know you're going to heaven, right? Why are you struggling so much? And hear his answer. In my lifetime, I have been often assaulted by Satan, and many times he has cast my sins in my teeth to bring me to despair. Yet God gave me strength to overcome his temptations. And now, that subtle serpent who never ceases to tempt has taken another course and seeks to persuade me that all my labors in the ministry and the fidelity I have showed in that service have merited heaven and immortality. So I'm being tempted in a new way. Satan has come to me and said, wow, you're ready to die. Look at all that you've achieved. Look at this great church. Look at all the believers. Look at how Scotland is a new country because of you. Great job, John. But blessed be God, he hath brought to my mind that scripture, what hast thou that thou hast not received? Not I, but the grace of God which is in me. Now I am sure my battle is at an end, that I shall shortly, without pain of body or trouble of spirit, change this mortal and miserable life for that happy and immortal life which will never have an end. As I had to get victory over the last temptation, and that was the temptation of thinking that anything that's been achieved was achieved by me. It was all God. And he died peacefully the following day, November 24th, 1572, at the age of 58. He had inducted a successor in the pulpit of Edinburgh. There is that pulpit. Earlier in the month, Andrew Melville, who's also going to be one of the great preachers in Scottish history. No monument was erected in his memory. He forbade it. He said, I don't want there to be any monument, no statues. It's not about me. Don't do it. Same thing Calvin did. They didn't want visible monuments. I think he was imitating Calvin in that respect. The monument to Knox is the Church of Scotland. It remained faithful to conservative theology for 400 years. And in fact, in the 19th century, in the first half of the 1800s, the Presbyterian Calvinists were sending out more missionaries per capita than any other denomination in the world. John Patton, the great missionary to the New Hebrides, came from this church. Andrew Murray, the great missionary in South Africa, came from this church. Horatius Bonar, many, many others. What had got, oh, by the way, if you'd like to see the grave of John Knox, they'll show it to you. It's under a parking space by a supermarket in Scotland. They say, there it is, space number such and such. That's where Knox is buried. It's really sad. What did God give Knox that made him such a powerful leader in the Kirk of Scotland? He truly believed in the sovereignty of God, and as a result, he could face tests in life with great boldness. Let me give you the principles of boldness one more time. Recognition of divine authority, trust in divine providence, burden for eternal souls, sense of divine mission, and a focus on God and not self. Those things are what I need at the moment that I want to shut up and turn tail and run and not do what I ought to do. I need the kind of truths that sustain Knox through a life of great ministry. Questions on the life of John Knox, or, as Pastor said, anything related to this conference or related to church history, and I might, you know, we have another night. If you give me a curveball, I could answer it maybe tomorrow. Yes, ma'am. Yes. Yeah, there's a biography by a man by the name of Bond. I think it's Colin Bond, B-O-N-D, and it's called The Mighty Weakness of John Knox. It's a very recent biography, just written in the last couple years, and it's a good one. It's short, it's very readable, and it's very accurate. The Mighty Weakness of John Knox. Who else? Yes, ma'am. Yes, his pastorate was in Edinburgh, the largest city of Scotland. And that's where that pulpit was that I showed. Other questions? By the way, if you're interested in biographies, there's not a really good biography of Zwingli that I can recommend to you. I've seen them in the book lists. I've not read one. My knowledge of Zwingli comes from a number of Reformation studies that I've read. But Martin Luther, as I mentioned yesterday, there's a wonderful biography called Here I Stand by Roland Bainton, B-A-I-N-T-O-N. And it's in your library, Pastor. I saw it in your house yesterday. Bainton's biography, Here I Stand, it's outstanding, and I strongly recommend it. And then William Tyndale, biography is called God's Outlaw. God's Outlaw, The Life of William Tyndale. It is a dynamic biography. I'm sorry, I can't remember the author's name, but if you look for God's Outlaw, you'll find it. And there's also a film, a religious film, that was made by Gateway Vision Video. Vision Video is what they're called now. They made a film on the life of William Tyndale called God's Outlaw, and it's a little dated now, but it tells the story quite well. And then, of course, the biography of Knox that I mentioned tonight by Bond is... And then if you'd like to read Knox's The History of the Reformation in Scotland by John Knox, that is a delightful read. Knox wrote it himself. It was my primary source for this study, and then I supplemented this with biographical material. It's called The History of the Reformation in Scotland, and it's by John Knox. It doesn't go all the way. It's told, Knox stops the story basically when they triumph. It doesn't tell... You know, it goes right up to Mary being kicked out of the country, and then it stops.